So good evening, everyone. It's nice to see many of you again and a few of you for the first time. I'm Deborah Margolis. I'm the librarian who works with the Muslim Studies program, and just welcome to our fourth, 4 out of 5 book club session this year. Tonight we are going to be discussing Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi, and because this was like published in two parts, some of you have like a book with the whole thing and some of you just have this, so that's been a little point of confusion, so I apologize for that. We're going to focus on this first part, the story of a childhood, which ends when she leaves Iran. Okay, but so we're going to focus on that. Next week, here at MSU, we're showing the animated film of Persepolis on Thursday, and there's a flyer for that next Thursday, not in this location, in Wells Hall. So there's a flyer for that event. I think we'll all want to go to that, right? Okay. And then next month is our last book club meeting, and it's going to be reading The Butterfly Mosque by G. Willow Wilson. And it's going to be here in this location. When we first advertised this program, it was advertised for being located at East Lansing Public Library, but it's here, okay? So don't go there. Here, thank you. And I really wanted to thank our outreach librarian, MSU Libraries outreach librarian, Holly Flynn, for helping me to facilitate all these programs. Thank you so much. And also to Mike Laney from our digital multimedia center, and for helping set this up, because we've got a lot of media here. Anyways, so what are we going to do tonight? We're going to have a short lecture from Dr. Amina Everett, which we're so excited about because she's a kind of beloved teacher here on campus and an historian, and I'll tell you a little bit more about her. And after about a half hour, we're actually going to physically get up and we're going to move to that back table so that we can all sit around the table and discuss the book, okay? And at that time, we have some graduate students from history and anthropology who are going to be helping lead that discussion. So I really want to thank Allison Kaludzi and Ella Fratan Tuono, Adrienne Tyree, and Kyle Craig for being here tonight and, you know, sharing their knowledge with us, and so happy to have them. They've definitely energized me, you know, at this point in the series, so thank you guys. And then at the end, if needed, there'll be time for questions and answers if needed, okay? So any questions about tonight or anything? No? Okay. There are refreshments in the back, so please, anytime you need to get up, please help yourself. And we also have a renovated restroom in the hall, so brand new, so if you need that, anytime. Okay, so to introduce Amina Everett, she's an historian of the Middle East and North Africa. She specializes in analyzing late Ottoman and early nationalist accounts of education and public health. And she uses those as a means to understand themes in modernization, nation building, and ethno-religious particularization. Her book, Empire and Education Under the Ottomans, was published in 2013 by I.B. Torres. And her recent articles, co-authored with Kyle Everett, look at the place of alcohol in early Republican Turkey. Dr. Everett is also core faculty in our MSU Muslim Studies program, and we're very happy to have her here tonight, so thank you. All right.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you all for being here. It's great to see you here, and it's great to have the opportunity to discuss one of my favorite books, Persepolis. When it came out in English, I received it as a birthday present, and it was, you know, a wonderful present to receive. And after a while, realizing how much these kind of comic books animate me as a gift, or son gave me a Christmas present, Operation Ajax. So those of you who are interested in Iranian history, those of you who watched Argo, this is a wonderful book to read. It's also a cartoon history of Iran. What I wanted to do today is not necessarily go over the book itself, because we'll have a discussion session, but after reading the book and realizing that some of the critiques of that book focused on how there was a little bit background missing for people who are not familiar with Iran's history to evaluate everything that they were going to read in the book. So as a historian, I'm not going to exhaust Iranian history here, but I'm going to fill that gap, and I'm going to give you a little bit more background than the book provides, so that we can have a fuller discussion once the presentation is over. Let me see, I was told that this one works. Perfect. Now, when we think about Iran, obviously we have all kinds of images, and a lot of them are not necessarily positive. But Iran as a country has a very long history, and Iranians and their sense of identity is very strong, and that history plays a very important role. So obviously, when you had Iranian Revolution, that was a turning point in terms of how Iranians were going to identify themselves. And I will bring you to that point to see what it meant to have a revolution that turned Islamic, what it means to have an Islamic revolution in Iran. But before I do that, I wanted to give you a sense of how people in Iran felt about the revolution 30 years after. In 2009, on the 30th anniversary of Iranian Revolution, BBC published an interview with two Iranians, one who lived in Iran at the time of the revolution, and the other was born a year after the revolution. It is striking to read their views of the revolution. It's really eye-opening in terms of how that revolution was remembered after 30 years. One of the individuals, Nurin, who took part in the revolution, expresses disappointment. Ramin, who was born in 1979, praises its achievements. Nurin, 51 at the time of the 30th anniversary, this is what he says. "We thought the Shah was at the root of every problem, so that by getting rid of this regime, we would get rid of all our problems. I see now that things I took for granted at the time, such as my free education, were privileges. I grew up in a poor rural family, but I still ended up going to university. I was a student at Tehran University in 1979, and I was active in the revolution. I didn't support the Islamic way of looking at things. I supported the leftist groups. We were on the streets most of the time, demonstrating and chanting slogans. We were very curious to see what would happen. Our hopes of freedom and justice were very vague. I don't think I had a clear idea of what they really meant. The changes came suddenly. Very soon we realized the old regime had gone and the new one had arrived. I feel great sadness and regret when I look back to the revolution for all the years we lost." The younger one, Ramin, who was born after revolution, living in Tehran, he has the following to say about revolution. "I think what will remain in the history of Iranian revolution is not the devastation, the pain, and how many were killed, but rather its achievements: independence, self-reliance, and self-sufficiency. Iran has taken huge leaps forward. 30 years ago, no one would have thought we could have launched a satellite into space or have access to nuclear technology." I didn't fact check that launching satellite into space, so I don't know if it's possible. "It's hard to be Iranian and not feel proud about the satellite. There have also been huge improvements in human development over the past 30 years. Access to clean water and life expectancy have gone up. I know my parents' generation are less satisfied with the results. They saw a golden age in Iran in the 1970s, when oil money was injected into the Iranian economy and the standards of living were improving. In their minds, I think they have seen Iran deteriorate over the past 30 years. But my generation grew up during 8 years of war with Iraq, that your book covers in details, and then Reconstruction. So for me, Iran has always been improving. I think that largely explains the contrast in attitudes. It doesn't mean that I'm happy with everything here. For example, the social restrictions or the mismanagement of social areas. I don't think governments should interfere in people's private lives. It is also true that corruption is widespread. However, this is a historic problem. It has been here for past 200 years. And I'll take you to that history a little bit. There are opportunities here that don't exist in more developed places. I'm an investment banker. And in Europe, I would have to be in my 50s to have the level of job I have here. I have lived and studied abroad, and with some international experience, you can progress much faster. Iran today is one of the most independent, self-reliant, and self-sufficient countries on the planet. After centuries of being a pushover, this is something to be truly proud of today. I'm not one of those who say that the Islamic State will soon disappear. But I think that for it to be sustainable, it has to learn to coexist with social and political freedoms. What really strikes you in the statement, especially the second one, that Iran today is one of the most independent, self-reliant, and self-sufficient countries on the planet, and that after centuries of being pushover, this is something to be truly proud of today. When you look at Iran's history, really, there are certain developments that explain many things that satrapies Persepolis cover. And so to that extent, I wanted us to look at modern history of Iran, a little bit history, to understand what it is that people always refer to when they talk about corruption, when they talk about bribery, when they talk about Iran being under the influence of foreign countries. And if you look at Iran, there are certain events in its history that comes up very often. The Arab invasion of Iran, conversion to Islam, the arrival of Shia Islam. But most importantly, in the 19th century, a new dynasty ruling Iran being pushed by two countries will change Iran's fate forever. So that 200 years is quite interesting for us to keep in mind in order to evaluate the book fully. So the great game in the 19th century was between Russia and Britain. Those two had interest in Russia, and they would make demands on Iran, and Iran would find itself. I use Iran and Persia interchangeably. Please forgive that, but I'm referring to the same country. The great game that those two countries were playing on Iran made the country and people feel uneasy about the developments. And obviously, the rulers of Iran, some of them are ancestors of Satrapi. Her great-grandfather was coming from Qajar dynasty. They launched major reforms so that Iran would have a modern army, modern bureaucracy, and that Iran can control its population, its resources. And those kind of reforms to centralize governing Iranian population were seen as a smart move, and many others around the same time were doing similar developments, similar programs to reform their countries. But these reforms obviously come with a price. You cannot open, you know, schools in every province for entire population and not have a bill. You cannot open hospitals or factories and not have the expenses built up. So in that sense, for the regime to pay the bills, they needed to have resources. And they would tax their population a bit heavily, and that would generate resentment. They would cultivate cash crops for the economy, world economy, and obviously there are certain things that you can grow but not necessarily feed yourself, right? Tobacco was big in Iran, sugar was big in Iran, but you can consume sugar, but it's a luxury item, not necessarily our lives depend on it. So in that sense, it's a change for Iran. But most importantly for the 19th century, Iran, borrowing from Europe was where, when you find the sort of this tension between the rulers and the ruled. And when you look at Persepolis, when you look at any other history of Iran, you will always have references to how foreigners came and ruled Iran. And Iranians themselves as people didn't want that, but that the rulers were accommodating that kind of interference. In Iran's history, in order to pay the modernization of its institutions, for instance, you have concessions given mostly to the British, and that their arrival and their desire to exploit resources in Iran would generate resentment, and we will follow that in a few slides. The concession given to the British Imperial Tobacco Company, it's a beautiful area of history. I look at history of alcohol and always it comes with tobacco, right? The twins. In the 19th century, the tobacco that had Fatima, the picture of a Muslim veiled woman, you're selling the culture at the same time, implied that the tobacco was coming from the Middle East and it was good quality of tobacco that you were selling. But that tobacco and this privilege given to British Tobacco Company made people in Iran feel resentful towards government because it was harming their own economic well-being. And notice here, and I emphasize this one, this turning point in terms of how the leaders, the ruler, the monarch, the Shah, is making the concessions, but on local level, for ordinary people, there emerges a leader for their resentment, and that was the ulama, the clergy in Iran. Now, this is a very interesting development because when the tobacco concession was given, it was affecting so many people that the ulama told people that it's detrimental for your well-being, and that unless the Shah cancels this privilege given to the British, let's quit smoking. And people say that in Iran, 9 out of 10 people smoke. So how do you convince Iranians to quit smoking, right? But that the resentment was so overwhelming that people quit. But obviously, it was temporary. It was an expression of their grievances at the time. But the important thing in that tobacco protest, and the Shah canceled the agreement, he had to pay indemnity, and so it became more expensive to cancel it because you pay extra money. And when they didn't have that money, they started borrowing from Europe. There was also one of the first oil privileges given to BP at the turn of the 20th century. So for people, the regime at the time, the dynasty ruling Iran, was selling Iran to Europeans in order to have quick cash. And those kind of developments lead to a constitutional revolution, and people who are resentful build up their efforts and get together, and they push for a constitutional revolution. And what they want is to limit the power of the Shah so that he is not going to make agreements on issues that population don't agree. Quite an important development at that time. But notice also, bringing the great game to the picture, afraid that this kind of new parliament and constitution is going to make Iran hard to deal with, Russians and the British shared Iran create zones, agree among themselves, and when World War I comes, they occupy Iran militarily. So it's in the midst of those kind of developments that you find this dynasty that was seen as selling the country disappears and a new one comes to power, ironically, with the support of the British. And to a certain extent that you can call two people ruling Iran as dynasty, at least the intention was to be dynastic. The father, Reza Shah, is very important for understanding your book. Now, Reza Shah in Iran transforms, or at least tries to transform, Iran's identity. Influenced by Mustafa Kemal in Turkey, you can always blame the Turk, right? He has an agenda. He's going to create a secular nation state in Iran. And that he's going to use history in a very selective manner to focus on pre-Islamic Iranian history to enhance the secular development. And he's going to eliminate all those Arabic and Turkish words that crept into Persian over the course of many centuries because they were constantly borrowing from one another, and then realized that 60% of Persian became Arabic and Persian. He couldn't pursue that one. But education was a great tool to create this secular nation state in Iran. He creates schools for boys and girls. It's an era of major developments. But the ideology is to create a modern Western-style state and society. Obviously, he had authoritarian tendencies too. It wasn't a republic, it was still a monarchy. Now, in terms of Iranian identity, one thing that you can easily contrast in terms of what was happening in Iran was how the Shah, in creating the secular narrative for Iranian nation, made Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, as a required reading for Iranians. Now, that book talks about how terrible it was that Iran was invaded by the Arabs. Those Arabs, if they didn't come, Iranians had everything perfect. So the arrival of Arabs that Persepolis talks about, as a child, she can say anything she wants, right? She talks about those, you know, bad Arabs coming. When Iranian revolution happens, the new regime will turn this narrative, turns this book and its author, all the statues built around Iran, upside down. For them, the arrival of Arabs was the best thing that ever happened to Iran. And so what I'm trying to get your attention to is the constructed nature of nationalism. And in this case, you are building a secular national identity. Reza Shah is also known for introducing new dress code for men and women. And so every time when I read Persepolis, there's something quotable for me. And this last time, it was the father telling this conservative woman when she was criticizing the young girl for not covering her hair, if the hair is so important, why don't you go and shave your own mustache? but in 1930s Iran, Reza Shah requires that women should be unveiled. And that women's bodies are always used in nation building. And in Iran, it is happening in a way that for people who were more conservative, it was unacceptable. Women at the time who were accustomed to covering themselves expressed their nervousness that it felt as if they were naked in public when they were not wearing chador or covering their heads. But men were not spared. Obviously, there's this sort of hair issue in Iran. They were supposed to wear Western clothing. They were supposed to shave their beard and mustache. Then in terms of clothing, all the differences had to be gone, and so Western clothing was seen suitable. Very similar developments took place in Turkey, but Turkey didn't punish people who covered themselves. They made it a fashion statement in Turkey. So in Iran, you find women gradually entering into public life. You find them in schools. And in 1950s and 60s, this reform that Father Reza Shah initiated took a life of its own, especially in Tehran. And people said that it was like being in Paris, and that the latest fashion in Paris would reach to Iran, especially to Tehran, very quickly. But things get a little bit hard when the father, Reza Shah, abdicated, and his son, Reza Pahlavi, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, just to confuse you, came to power. Now, it's at his time that the revolution will take place. He's quite important. He's young. He's pressured by Western powers. And there is Russia right next door. You have Cold War politics. And for him, against Russia, well, it's no-brainer. You have the United States to rely on. It's under his dynasty that the major problem in Iran that created a rift and anxiety happened. That was the nationalization of Iran, Iran's oil, because Britain started making more money from Iran's oil, and Iranians were still getting the same small amount, and they demanded 50-50 split, and Britain didn't accept that. And then Mossadegh decided that he was going to nationalize Iran's oil. Iran's oil belonged to Iranians. Well, if you are in Iran, you are going to have sympathy for this man. But the games played over Iran are so multidimensional that you really have to bring several factors into picture. And that the British and the United States didn't like what they were seeing in Iran. Russia had influence on some Iranian youths. And Mossadegh had to go. And that with the joint operation between US and Britain called Operation Ajax, it was a cleanup operation after all. It was cleaning Iran from commies, and Mossadegh was gone. But when everything was falling apart in Iran, the Shah escaped. He came back when everything was cleaned up, and he became king again. If you were living in Iran at the time, wouldn't you consider the legitimacy of this kind of rule? You sure? Everybody knew that the Shah was brought back by Iran, by the United States. But what was it to the United States that they wanted to go and meddle into Iran's affairs? It was Cold War. It was the existence of oil. And Iran, because of its geographic location, because of the oil, was quite essential for the United States. And therefore, Iran gets assigned this role of being the guardian for the Middle East. And in this divided Cold War Middle East, whether you sided with the Soviet Union or the United States mattered dramatically. So Mossadegh is gone, but there is a ruler in Iran whose reign is not legitimate in the eyes of many people. And when you look at Iranian society at the time, aside from those grievances over the issue of legitimacy, you also find that in Iran, there were tendencies towards modernizing, westernizing Iran. And that people who had money, interest, and saw Europe as a role model emulated Europe. But for those who were more conservative, who were not benefiting from Iran or Iran's oil as much, the development was such that the book I have here, Garbzedegi, and when you translate it, Plagued by the West, became quite influential. People refer to this book as, in terms of its impact, equal to the Communist Manifesto. Because for Iranians, it was the book that they read. It was the book that they felt like it was articulating how they felt about their society. And when you have this passage from Garbzedegi, you realize that for them, when they see Iran, It's a totally cultural imperialism that dominates Iran, and that Iranians don't have a sense of who they are, and that they want to be European, they want to emulate West, and it comes at the expense of their own identity. So that sense of loss of their national identity, for some, was quite detrimental, and they didn't like how things were shaping up in Iran. But it was Mohammad Reza Shah who feared most about the kind of books that Garbzadegi is. It was him who was having nightmares that another Mossadegh type of person will come and take over. He had anxiety over his legitimacy. And that he was afraid that Russia is having too much influence on Iranian youth, and he kept buying more weapons from the United States. Iran made a lot of money, but Iran was main buyer of American weapons. And Iran was the fifth in terms of its military around the world, so it was a big buildup. But in terms of grievances, political, economic, you have to add to, and this book covers in details, the grievances over the Shah's secret service, SAVAK. Brutal in terms of its treatment of anyone who opposed the Shah, tortured people, and generated jokes in the Middle East. There is one that says the members of CIA, members of Mossad, and members of SAVAK agreed on a contest that they were going to release a rabbit to the forest, and whoever brings it back will prove that that country has the best secret service. They release the rabbit, and CIA members come within an hour with the rabbit in hand. Members of the Mossadegh come. They say, we couldn't find it. But members of SAVAK are nowhere to be seen. Hours later, they decide to go and look for it. They go, and they find that the members of SAVAK had a donkey tied to a tree. They were beating the donkey and screaming, confess it, you're a rabbit. And they say that this joke got translated to any given country in the Middle East. That if you were living in Syria, they would bring their own secret service, but that the joke is suitable to most countries in the region itself. So when the Iranian Revolution took place, all those grievances that people had about the regime, all those people who lost because the Shah didn't make an alliance with the clergy and rather went after them and took away their resources. And those liberals who disliked Shah because he was heavy-handed and SAVAK was brutal to anyone who expressed disagreement with the ruling regime allied themselves and generated a revolt that shocked everybody, including the United States. Having involved in Iran for so long and so well, people felt that the U.S. would anticipate or knew that it was coming. But what people didn't anticipate that such different groups, the leftists and the conservatives, would come together and topple down a regime that seemed undefeatable because U.S. was behind it. But it did. But that alliance later on, as the book beautifully illustrates, will turn against one another, and the clergy, the ulama, will go after the leftists that they allied themselves with to defeat the Shah. Everyone knew one thing. Reports note that people knew that they wanted one thing, that the Shah should go, but nobody knew what should come. And I think that's the unfortunate thing for many revolutions in the Middle East, all around the world, and that for revolutionaries, they know what should be gone, but they don't know what should replace it. And then it unleashes a lot of problem for people in the country, unexpected consequences of revolution. That is the topic for this book itself that we can sit and talk about. So it's against this background and the arrival of Khomeini as the leader for the conservative voices that the book is written. And I think we can keep this kind of background in mind when we discuss the book. With that, I'm done. I took more time than I expected.